Thank you very much, Ms. Fuller. My thanks to all of you for coming and for all of the hospitality I felt in Arizona, since I came. I'm grateful for all kinds of things, and perhaps specifically for one little linguistic acquisition which I've made here. I've been assembling over the years remarks that I somehow stumble into, which I mean as compliments and which turn out to be just the opposite. And I heard a rather good one, I think, here, which I pass on not just so I can start the evening with the jokes that those unaccustomed to are supposed to, but because it is of some interest, I think, to people who care about language. I think I stumbled into the first of these. There's a Greek name for this, noema, I think, when the opposite of the intention intended is conveyed. I think the first one happened to me at the Breadloaf Writers Conference when, as we were walking across the street toward dinner, a lady said, may I take your hand in case I break my leg? And I said, I wish you would. That's one. Or another was also at Breadloaf on a last morning there, and that means after all of the farewell parties the night before, and that means people were not quite as perceptive as they had been other mornings, and it means people were more confused, and there was more chaos around than usual, and everybody was dashing around at breakfast saying, goodbye, see you next year, goodbye, goodbye. It was rather wearisome, and I turned to the lady next to me and said, meaning well, and said, I don't want to say goodbye to anyone except you. The third example happened the other night, right here. This is the Arizona contribution, when someone in town asked me in for a drink before dinner, and the lady had been away for a couple of weeks, and the provisions were all in a kind of garage, I guess it was. And she said, "Would you help me bring in this stuff?" And so we went out there, and here was this large case. And I said, "Do you want me to bring the whole case in?" And she said, "Yes, since you're here." But all this meant was, of course, it's sort of heavy, and I wish you'd help me with it while someone is here. But that's the third noema, if that's indeed the word for it. People who write poetry are interested in ambiguities, and this is a kind of ambiguity. A kind of double meaning, though not exactly in the classic sense, and I don't know whether poets can aim at this figure of speech or not. Maybe. I thought I'd start, though, after that gracious introduction and after all of this hospitality, by biting the hand that feeds me, by saying what I can against poetry readings. I really don't like poetry readings at all, at least other people's poetry readings. And I think there's a great... if you haven't heard the case against them, maybe you ought to. There's a good deal to be said against poetry readings, besides the fact that they're intrinsically boring for everybody except the reader, unless one's name is Dylan Thomas, maybe. And that is that they misrepresent... No, first of all, it's impossible to get a new poem on hearing it. As Jorge Guillén, the Spanish poet, said, a poem is not read until it's reread. Or you could say until it's reread and reread and reread. And good poems don't communicate on the fly. If one is reading poems you already know, perhaps it's all right to listen to the reading of the poems. It can't hurt, I suppose. But it doesn't help much to hear a new poem read. And a second caution about poetry readings is that The poem, after all, is what gets embodied in words. This is all that matters. It has nothing to do with the personality of the writer. And if one perceives the poem through the personality of the writer, he confuses the two. I've seen some classic examples of this kind of thing. Again, at Breadloaf one summer, there was a very handsome waiter, I guess. He was a tall, bronzed boy with a beautiful voice, and he read his poems. And girls swooned, sort of. Well, the poems weren't any good, but how did they know? They weren't just listening. They were looking at this gorgeous figure and listening to this marvelous voice, and they didn't realize that what was coming out of this very masculine throat was a series of puny little poems that wouldn't have looked any good on the page. They weren't any good, and they were confusing the poems with the personality of the poet. Or the reverse can happen. They tell me that a few years ago, a very good English poet read at Harvard, and he was a very unimpressive man, meek little Caspar Milto sort of man. He read his poems very timidly. They weren't well received because nobody heard the poems. As the poems were extremely strong and vibrant and masculine, and they're with us as long as there's an English language. But people at the reading didn't know that. And he was followed by a second reader who had dramatic training or something of that sort and was dressed for the part and was again tall and bronzed. And the poems weren't any good, but he got a tremendous hand. It's very, very difficult, I think, to discriminate between the person reading and the poems read. And this is why I warn you against poetry readings. And I do what I can to undermine their popularity. I give them now and then. And that, I think, should do it. But I really wish... There was a review recently in the London Times Literary Supplement of a new book by Philip Larkin, who's a very good English poet, I think. And it said, Mr. Larkin has refused almost all invitations to judge, recite, review, lecture, pontificate, be interviewed, and has continued to produce his rare and fine poems. This is really what we should do, and what one wants to say to a number of young poets who are interested in lecture tours. Beware of the poets who read a lot, I can tell you that. But what one wants to say to the young people interested in this is, go home and shut up. Go home and get to work. Be like Frost, work for 20 years without paying any attention to publication and making this or that magazine or getting on this or that lecture schedule. This is the admirable thing to do. And when one has enough character, this is what he does. He stays home. But I like Tucson and people in Tucson. I sort of wish, though, I could say with Alexander Pope, I ne'er with wits or witlings passed my days to spread about the itch of verse and praise, nor like a puppy daggled through the town to fetch and carry sing-song up and down, which is what the readers do. Well, I guess I'm going to fetch and carry a little sing-song, I hope, because I rather felt this is one poetry reading I shouldn't miss. So here it is. My favorite remark about a poetry reading, I think, is what a listener is supposed to have said to one poet after his reading. A young man came up and said, Sir, that last poem, was that a real poem or did you make that up? I thought I might start with a few real poems that I didn't make up, a couple of translations, that is, chiefly from St. John of the Cross. And I don't suppose I have to say again, since I've been saying often lately, that poetry is untranslatable, and that, as Robert Frost said, poetry is what is lost in translation. Poetry is what is lost in translation, because poetry is poetry because of a particularly intimate connection between what is said and the way it's said, and what is said is not poetry. And many translators just give us what is said, which is not the poem at all, of course, and is a little bit like, as I said, I guess, this morning, a little bit like judging a beauty contest by x-rays. What do you do when you're translating a poem? One thing you can do is what Valéry called something like the technique of equivalent effect. That is, don't try to give the thought of the poem. Try to recreate something which in your language has what you take to be the effect the original had in its language. And that way the readers know what kind of poet the poet is. If they hear the thought, they have no idea what kind of poet he is. And this is what I tried to do with the poems of St. John of the Cross. I can't say I did it. I can't say tonight that my reading of any of the poems I read constitutes any particular approval of these poems. They're just the only ones I have to read. But this is what I was trying to do in this translation. And when you do this, what you do is take the thought of the original poem, you try to find out what kind of diction it was. And you can only do this by having spoken the language since you were a child, the other language, or else having that most useful of scholarly tools in translation, a friendly native. And you talk to this person and say, not what does this word mean, that doesn't matter so much in the poetry, but when would you use it? What has been its history in your language? Is it a formal word or an informal word? Would a child use it? You have to get the tone of the word, and no dictionary will give you that. If you don't do this in translating, you make all kinds of boners. A recent translation of Octavio Paz, they tell me, has hundreds of plain boners in it, because the translator, looking at the Spanish word hombro, which means shoulder, thinks she's looking at hombre, which means man. That's a boner. It's not taking a liberty, it's a plain boner. And ugliness and ignorance is always ugliness, it seems to me. And a great many translators are ignorant. I don't think anybody who doesn't know a language very well or know this friendly native ought to translate it. And young poets are translating all over the place, as you know. One is translating from the Scandinavian because he lived a year in Sweden or somewhere. A man in Swedish at Harvard tells me the book has hundreds of simple mistakes that anybody should know. Clearly, this translator was arrogant. It never occurred to him to check up on little things. This, I think, is pretty bad. There's some famous boners in the history of translation. One of my favorites is the story of the Spaniard who was translating Emily Dickinson and came across the line, "I never saw a Moor." Well, I don't have to even finish this story. The Spaniard knew very well what a Moor was. He'd read Spanish history, but he had all kinds of trouble with the rest of the poem trying to make it make sense. Or another good example is the Italian translation I saw of a poem by Kenneth Patchen, which has the line, a girl says, "Why don't you come up and see me tonight? I've got nothing on." The Italian didn't know that idiom. That was a real boner. And history of translations, I suppose, are full of remarks of this sort. I don't say there aren't any boners here. I do say there are lots of liberties, that what this translator tried to do was take the thought, the diction, and it was this matter of diction that has distracted me for a while. The diction, the rhythm. You'll find lots of poets who will tell you the rhythm is more important than the thought. As far as a poem goes, that is, if it doesn't have a rhythm, it's just not a poem. Whereas if it doesn't have a thought, maybe it is. Anyway, maybe it is. The rhythm, the stanza form. I think what you do is take all of these things and then try to write a new poem, incorporating as many as you can, and knowing perfectly well you're not going to get all of them. You know you're not. Translation is a kind of lost cause in a way. But here is a translation of one of St. John's poems, the poem about the dark night. I think it's mimeographed. I don't know what page, though. 6. I was surprised to find out that St. John of the Cross is one of the greatest poets in Spanish. I thought that he was a famous mystic referred to by T.S. Eliot and a few others. But no, Spaniards know him as a very great poet, one of the greatest in their language. Many critics would say the greatest for a few poems. One critic has said that the highest points in St. John are the highest points reached by poetry in any of the Romance languages. But this is only for a few poems. Why is he good? Well, this is a religious poem. Religious poems are terribly hard to write. As T.S. Eliot says, because few people are really religious, passionately religious, and of those who are passionately religious, few are also good poets. And most people, he says, in religious poems don't say how they feel, but how they think they ought to feel, what is proper to feel. Well, St. John was passionate and a great poet too, and these are perhaps as great as any religious poems are. And they're great for one thing, because they don't insist on being religious at all. In fact, Spanish girls have told me that when they were young, they read these poems and thought they were human love poems. And I'd like to say that this is what they would have to sound like if they're good poems. Because what can one say in terms of the senses? And I think a point that one has to insist on about poetry is that it's a very sensuous kind of thing, really very primitive, and that people who write intellectual poetry aren't writing poetry at all, because poetry is a kind of expression of the whole man. It's physiological, really sort of a vulgar thing, poetry, instead of a highbrow thing, which is why García Lorca said the poet is a professor of the five senses. If he isn't that, he isn't a poet. This is his field, the five senses. And if one is going to write poems about God, one has to write them in terms of the senses in some way. And St. John of the Cross looked for the best image we have for divine love and found it in human love, as the Song of Songs did. Human love, he felt, is the best and most exciting thing we know in the kind of experiences we have. And so he writes this whole poem as if it were a human love poem. And there's no place in the poem, I think, where you can say it isn't a human love poem. And if there were any place like this, it would be a poorer poem, I think. It's meaningful on the two levels.